Welcome, welcome, beloved listeners, to another week of the Little Wireless program. And I often joke that our theme is sung by Laura Tingle. Not the case, but let the record show that Laura has a lovely voice, and we're about to mingle with Tingle, and I'm going to raise that issue with her. Later, we're going to, absolutely nothing to do with Laura, we're looking at the Witches of Salem and trying to see whether those that tumultuous time is a pre-echo of perhaps what we're going through with the young being seduced by ISIS. First of all, welcome, Laura. Thank you for joining me on our little program. I want to discuss Malcolm Turnbull with you shortly, but first of all, another Messiah, please.
Oh, yes, another Messiah, Philip. Indeed, Canberra Choral Society, December 12, Llewellyn Hall. We're coming back to Messiah. And it's a wonderful piece and very exciting. And we get all the other choirs in Canberra to come along and sing with us. So there'll be 200 people being cheery, which is one of course, Handel's great things.
And one of Malcolm Turnbull's. So, it's wonderful the way these two stories of ours are blending and intermingling. Now, a colleague of mine has thrust into my hand a document as yellowed and ancient as the Dead Sea Scrolls. It's a copy of the Australian from the 1980s, wherein you write about John Button's innovation plans. So before we talk about Malcolm's, how many innovation nations have we had over the past 40 years?
Look, it's been quite a lot. I mean, I think it really started to gain momentum once we stopped talking about industry policy being about tariffs and protection, and suddenly, and it was really, I think, probably the Hawke government which really started to sort of regularly savage tariffs as opposed to the one-off of the Whitlam era. And so people were sort of saying, well, how do we make smart things? And you look back at that period from the 1980s and the optimism about how quickly you could transform the economy was sort of touching when you look back on it. I mean, do you remember the J curve where we would have a bit of a deterioration in the balance of payments as we bought lots of really groovy equipment to make ourselves very high tech, and then in the balance of payments would be fixed within a period of a few years. It was all one of those ideas that somehow if you just invested a bit of money in upgrading our manufacturing base, everything would be wonderful. Since then, I don't know, we've probably had 4 or 5 rounds of hopes about becoming a smarter country and things. Innovation has often been mentioned under both sides of politics. And, I mean, I think, Philip, it sort of has sort of happened without the government necessarily being all that involved. There is a lot of really smart stuff that goes on in Australia, but it's not of a piece with what we should be able to achieve given our economic status in the world.
So when Malcolm talks about an innovation nation, is he basically reading from the same page as Button?
Well, I think the debate has moved on since then. I mean, John Button was really looking at trying to transform manufacturing, if you like, and you know, there was always lots of pictures of robots building cars and things like that. I think it's moved on from there, partly just because technology has moved on, partly because we don't really have much of a manufacturing sector anymore. So it's now about using our intellects, if you like, using technology and IT, and funneling all the things that the interwebby allow us to do without actually creating very large robot-y things. That's my technical explanation anyway.
Beautifully done, beautifully done. Well, if make a reference to the Messiah in relation to Malcolm's leadership, your press gallery colleague Peter Harcher chose another inspirational figure. Did you see that at the weekend he quoted Mao in relation to Malcolm?
Well, Malcolm quoted Mao, it seemed, which has earned the absolute spewing wrath of Andrew Bolt, I noticed today as well. The horror and of the Prime Minister quoting Mao about standing up for China and adopting this about standing up for Australia. It's an interesting period in Canberra at the moment, Philip. I mean, the right is beside itself because it thinks that sort of outrageous things like banning anti-abortion activists shows that Malcolm Turnbull is a lefty in the grip of the Love media. The left have all these expectations about what Malcolm Turnbull will do, and what the position of the Prime Minister actually is that the circumstances are that, as we've discussed before, he can only change so much in a short period of time without the entire delicate structure that is the coalition falling to pieces. But in some ways, if you look at what he's done, and he's done this big round of interviews over the weekend with the major print media outlets, all he's done in a way is something that's sort of pretty blindingly obvious, which is put stuff back on the table which should have always been on the table. Now, people can criticise him for not doing enough already after 5 weeks, but all these things that had been insanely ruled out by the former Prime Minister are now open for discussion again. And I think the way Malcolm Turnbull's playing these things is reasonably smart. He's talking about, for example, union corruption, but instead of saying, oh, this is all terrible about the Labor Party, he's saying, look, there is union corruption there, and I could put in legislation to get the Building and Construction Commission back in place, but Labor's not going to allow us. I'm basically laying down the challenge for Labor to come to terms with this and find a way of dealing with it. So there's a bit of almost delegation going on in him trying to rewrite the political script. And given we've been so locked into this black and white world of, you know, Team Tony or not Team Tony, mainstream Australia or lefties, I think you shouldn't underestimate the difficulty or the challenge of actually reconfiguring the debate and the way we talk about these things.
I'm mingling with Tingle. Laura, on the weekend when you were avoiding politics, there were two contrasting headlines, one suggesting that Malcolm would spend money to lift Australia out of its economic problems, the other that it was important not to go into debt and spend all the extra money on tax cuts and middle-class welfare, as happened under the Howard government. To some extent, he is tailoring his media interviews for different audiences, and I suspect hoping that no one would see the contradictions.
Well, he might be. Of course, it also depends on what questions he's asked by said media outlets, I suppose. And the two things that he has said that you've just referred to there aren't necessarily inconsistent. I mean, he's talking on the one hand about essentially using government guarantees, I think, to lower the cost of finance for some infrastructure deals, which is something that doesn't actually materially affect the budget bottom line, though it's quite controversial for a coalition person to be saying that. On the face of it, then again, the government had already announced in the May budget, to some hilarity as it turned out, that it was going to have this $5 billion infrastructure fund in Northern Australia. Now, it was sort of greeted with some hilarity because it was literally a one line in the budget statement, and 6 or 7 months later, there's not a whole heap of detail about what they mean there. So there is some consistency on that. What I think he's saying about the budget is, what I thought was most interesting about what he said about the budget was he was borrowing a line, strangely, from Colin Barnett in Western Australia, who sort of says, look, what's this big hang-up about the actual forecasts for the budget? You know we're roughly heading somewhere, and, the forecasts are basically our best-guess hypothesis, and we shouldn't get too worried about the figures. We essentially want to do two things. We want to try to constrain spending, and we have to hope that revenue, that is taxes, gradually lift as the economy lifts and eventually brings us back to surplus. But all of the surplus fetish of the last 15, 20 years is really just sort of been blown up over the course of the last few years as proved impossible for Joe Hockey and Tony Abbott to fix it. And I think Malcolm Turnbull's language about taxes and spending is really just the next iteration of the move along that line towards a position where all you can do is sort of set down the basic goals of where you want to go with policy and hope for the best that you get there.
One of the things that I find most impressive in his weekend's performance is the way he moves away from sloganising into political complexities or subtleties. Mm. He's now telling us not to be shocked if he changes direction, changes his mind. This is not evidence of stupidity or fallibility so much. Well, yes, fallibility, admitting that sometimes things don't play out the way you expect them.
Mm. Yeah, well, I mean, isn't that refreshing? I find it pretty refreshing, this idea that you couldn't possibly change direction because it would be a sign of some kind of machismo weakness or anything is just ridiculous. And it once again goes back to this sort of whole idea of, you know, grey being the new black. You know, politics is by definition about complicated things which involve compromise. And we've been sort of playing this stupid game for the last 4 or 5 years of suggesting that it is either one thing or the other, it's either black or white. So Malcolm Turnbull is giving himself as much space as possible to find compromises without looking like, because he's inevitably going to be attacked, particularly from the right, about making compromises. But he's also putting a lot of pressure, I think, on Labor not to just do the knee-jerk reaction and run the scare campaign. He's basically sort of staring them down and saying, well, look, run a scare campaign if you will, but that will make you the lesser politician. I think Labor recognises that and is having a bit of trouble working out exactly how they play the game with Malcolm Turnbull on how they come across as positive, but also sort of criticise what he does.
Going back to journalism at the weekend, a mutual friend of ours, Alan Ramsey, gave Shorten some advice, too late to use it, sadly, but Alan feels that Labor completely ballsed up the attack on Malcolm's investment in the Caymans, and there was another better approach.
There probably was a better approach to it. I think Labor sort of still argues that it had to go out there and make the case that just imprint on people that there was something vaguely dodgy about the Cayman Islands link. They say it wasn't about about Malcolm Turnbull being wealthy. It was about this about his tax evasion or his links with a place that's linked with tax evasion. Let me be careful what I say here. So they stoically say that, even though they know that it cost them a lot at the time in terms of credibility.
Alan suggested that the focus should have been on his willingness or energies regarding investment within Australia. But you don't write Alan's columns, and nor do I.
Well, I don't. And I'm not. Well, I mean, that would have been a way to go. But I think that the Prime Minister has made an alternative case about the difficulties of actually investing in Australia if you're the Prime Minister, which is the point that Alan sort of also went to. But I think that is more a dilemma which Turnbull has pointed out in the Parliament, which is, well, how do I invest in Australia without running into all sorts of conflicts of interest situations?
I heard the phone ring in the background. It's almost certainly Malcolm. Laura, thank you very much. And we're all going to come along to the Messiah in December.
Excellent.
En masse. So I hope the venue can accommodate us. Laura Tingle, political editor of the Australian Financial Review, coming up next on LNL. We go to 1692 and the trial of witches in Salem. In recent times, beloved listeners, we've heard a lot about the emerging threat of young boys and girls being radicalised over the internet, being lured by the Islamic State preaching their apocalyptic worldview, where death, sacrifice and strict interpretations of religious texts are the norm. The revelation that a 12-year-old was amongst the terrorist suspects has shocked the country, according to media reports, and there are constant stories of children even younger being recruited to the cause of IS. What possesses these kids to fall victim to such a brutal ideology? And we use that word possession deliberately because in 1692, in the extremely religious colony of Massachusetts in North America, kids as young as five were accused of witchcraft. We talk, of course, of the Salem witch trials, and we all think we know what happened at Salem, largely because of Arthur Miller's play The Crucible. Shortly before Arthur died, he was one of my few remaining heroes and far and away my favourite American playwright. We talked on the program at considerable length, principally about Death of a Salesman, but to some extent about The Crucible. And of course, Arthur had some experience of these sort of trials in that he'd been a witness at the Nuremberg trials and saw in The Crucible a chance to be metaphoric about the witch hunts that were going on in US during its McCarthy era. But there are numerous other films and television shows. Our next guest, Pulitzer Prize-winning historian Stacey Schiff, calls the Salem witch trials an American national nightmare. Quote, "It crackles, flickers, and jolts its way through American history and literature." And Stacey's new book, The Witches, just released in the US early next month, here in Australia, and she joins our little wireless program on The Blower from her home in New York. Welcome, Stacey.
Thank you, Philip.
Now, let's set this up. Describe for us what kind of place Salem was, and indeed the colony of Massachusetts, in the 17th century.
Well, you're essentially at the very beginning of America. You're three generations into the founding of New England, anyway. You're talking about very isolated, very small communities, all of them farming communities. And in the case of Salem, a village of really 500 or 550 people, very much on the edge, really grappling at most times with a threat of Indian attack. They have already suffered a very traumatic Indian war from which most people are only just now recovering, and they're about to fight another one. So a very religious community, very much on the edge, feeling as if they're on the edge of a wilderness, and very much under siege economically, politically, for different reasons, which we can talk about, and obviously physically, because they are all living in fear of yet another Indian attack.
You write or highlight several times in your book about the significance of them being in the dark, literally and philosophically. What did you mean?
Well, actually, it isn't so much philosophical as it is an actual palpable blackness. And it took me a long time to get my mind around that because, of course, we live in such an electrified world where we really don't ever experience that kind of dark. But if you begin to read the court accounts, and I don't even mean the witchcraft court, but the criminal court accounts of the prior years, you repeatedly come up against people women particularly, getting into bed at night and finding a stranger in their bed whom they couldn't see from across the room, or a girl walking into a barn to milk the cows and being assaulted by a man who's lurking there, or for that matter, a young man, this during the witchcraft trials, who's afraid to ride home at night from the center of town through the darkness. People really being disoriented and alienated in the darkness, or seeing things move in the darkness that aren't necessarily what they think they are.
Last year, I talked to one of Australia's most famous historians about the subject of moonlight, and he pointed out that in this country, moonlight was the only thing that made visiting possible between farms. It made it possible for our bush rangers, who were our horse-mounted gangsters, to rob banks and to escape from the police. So I'm getting what you mean, the physicality of darkness.
Yeah.
Not simply a metaphor.
it's almost as if it's a player in the story. I mean, there's a wonderful Italian proverb, in the dark, every cat is a leopard. And there really is that sense of enhanced fears, enhanced spirituality, reinforced imagination, and reinforced anxiety. That's when we worry. I mean, even today, that's when our fears come back and grab us by the throats. And you really get a sense of that throughout this story.
We're going to start telling the story in just a minute, but we hear too much today about how social media spreads gossip. You point out that in 17th century Salem, the muttering of the locals about news also managed to spread with amazing speed. Muttering.
Well, you know, it's funny. It took me a little bit of time to realize, wait, there were no newspapers yet in New England in the 17th century. And you therefore begin to think, especially given the distances among farms, that news must have traveled with difficulty. But in fact, quite the opposite turns out to be true. The oral culture turns out to be a very effective one in terms of spreading the news, but a somewhat unreliable one in terms of spreading news which is also true. So you get a lot of this almost demented game of telephone, of things repeated over and over again, and this will play a great part in the tragedy, gathering a force and a new dimension with each retelling.
Now, we're going to start telling the story that begins officially in February 1692, but before then, I have to point out to the listener that all sorts of amazing theories about what happened in Massachusetts have been proffered, including a behavioral psychologist in the 70s suggesting that the rantings and ravings were caused by an hallucinogenic fungus on moldy rye bread. You had to hack your way through a lot of this, Stacey.
I actually think that's a very elegant theory. It unfortunately doesn't hold up, but what the villagers describe, I mean, demonic talking cats and goblins by the hearthside, trees that can migrate freely across a field, they do sound as if they're on some kind of acid trip. So I actually kind of like that theory. Unfortunately, it doesn't explain why the people who are afflicted and who do seem to be hallucinating are only sometimes afflicted, and nor does it explain why certain members of the household will be tortured and other members of the household are perfectly fine. So it also isn't the right time of year. There are any number of reasons why that theory doesn't hold up. It was important to me with this retelling of Salem not to begin with the theories in any event, but to begin with the people and to really home in on what their fears and concerns were, on their humanity, and to see what was driving them and obsessing them, and to work from there out toward the ideas as opposed to the other way around.
You write that Salem is in part the story of what happens when a set of unanswerable questions meets a set of unquestioned answers. I like that.
That to me is the definition, I guess, of fundamentalism, isn't it? And it occurred to me as I was working that there are only a couple of sets of people who feel that certainty ever about events. A fundamentally religious person will have that kind of certainty. A prosecutor will often approach something with that kind of certainty. And, of course, an adolescent will embrace an idea with that kind of certainty. And this is, in so many ways, a story of adolescence.
Okay, let's now look at February 1692 and a particular event.
What you essentially have is, out of the blue, and not for the first time, two little girls, a 9-year-old and an 11-year-old, one of them the daughter and one of them the niece of the Salem village minister, who begin to twitch and contort and writhe and essentially act out. They speak out of turn, they interrupt sermons, they scream piercingly at the tops of their lungs. They disappear down wells, they hide in corners, they attempt to fly across the room. And in all fairness, the minister, who is a somewhat doctrinaire type, does not leap immediately to the conclusion that they are bewitched. He waits some time before getting that diagnosis. But those symptoms in 17th century America, as elsewhere, were understood to be the symptoms of witchcraft. And so within a matter of weeks, the girls are thought to be bewitched. Three names will be named of who bewitches them, because, of course, you can't be bewitched without there being a culprit, and very shortly thereafter, the symptoms will spread.
You actually take it back a little earlier than that, and you talk about little girls crawling under the furniture, making silly noises, spreading their arms out like wings, etc. And as you say, the strangest thing to any person who spent more than 10 minutes in a kindergarten is that this was deemed strange at all.
Yes, but you know, the interesting thing is, as much as we will recognize some of these symptoms as normal, crazy adolescence, is that the same thing had happened several years earlier. And this, there is a 1689 case, and a very much written about 1689 case, in which yet again a set of children in New England experience the same symptoms and are understood to be bewitched by a neighborhood laundress who, in fact, will hang in 1688. So there is some precedent for this, which is clearly in the forefront of most people's minds. And I would say this is, even for an adolescent, this is extreme behavior. And I think also the kind of behavior that sends a parent around the bend. I mean, it's very hard to see a child in pain, much less a child who's in so much pain that no one else in the household can sleep.
Now, when you look back at the contemporary records, the court documents, the eyewitness accounts, you have to be astonished at how things got out of control so quickly. And let us tell the listener that by autumn, it had developed into a very grown-up business. 20 men and women, ages 20 to 80, had been executed under the imprimatur of the highest officials in Massachusetts.
Yeah, there are a couple of things. There are so many surprises in this story, but among the greatest are the way the story builds. It begins as a simple, so to speak, case of witchcraft, and very shortly thereafter, it will turn into a diabolical conspiracy, which was understood to be in confederacy with the devil. So fairly soon after the witches are identified, it seems that there is a whole league of diabolical confederates at work. And then it will turn out that it's not simply a witchcraft crisis, it's a conspiracy against the state and the church, and that this league of diabolical creatures intends to subvert the, at that point, very fragile colony of Massachusetts and Puritanism while they're at it. So it becomes this much greater force than it originally had been. And yes, then what is another great surprise is that both men and women are accused. People are accused, as you say, by their own families, by their own ministers, by their own parishioners, because ministers are also accused. And many adult women also will begin to experience the same symptoms.
Well, so when you look at the numbers involved, it's a significant part of the population.
It's a huge part of the population. And in fact, in Andover, which is a community away, and interesting that we call them the Salem Witch Trials, because in Andover, which is just down the road, it's estimated that 1 in 10 people was accused. And the town is just decimated by accusations, which, and when you look at it, it's largely along family lines. So certain families were from every direction targeted by their friends and their neighbors and their fellow parishioners.
I accept that both genders were involved in the accusations, but as you point out, Salem is a story in which women, strong-minded women and trembling, observing women, upright matrons and wayward teenagers played decisive roles. And you talk about this very powerfully and persuasively.
You know, one of the other interesting things about Salem is that unlike every other witchcraft trial, those who confess will not hang or will not be executed. Strangely enough, it is the noble person, it is the defiant suspect, it is the straight-spined, pious woman who, when she goes into court and insists on her innocence, will not be let off and who will die. Whereas those who give the authorities what they want, which is to say a confession, will end up back in prison, but they ultimately will survive the tragedy. So there's a strange inversion going on here.
Is there a pre-echo of the show trials that we know well from the communist world? In other words, are certain rituals absolutely demanded?
You can see that to some extent, I guess, of the questioning, because the questioning is, it's truly a no way out, you don't have a chance kind of questioning. The woman who goes into court and says, I'm not a witch, I don't even know what a witch is then asked, how can you be sure you're not one if you don't know what one is? So it's that kind of, of impossible to defeat logic. However, two things are different. One is that there were communists, to some extent. There were no witches, so to my, the best of my knowledge. And secondly, these the men in charge here are the most enlightened, most erudite, most pious men in the community. So it's a sort of it's almost a worse it's a more dramatic moment in a way, because these trials, which are really pretty much performed to the letter of the law, are being led by the most benevolent and best read authorities.
LNL on RN, on air, online, on your pod. And I'm talking to Pulitzer Prize-winning historian Stacey Sheff. I should point out that she's won a lot more than Pulitzer's. The woman's mantelpiece must need reinforcing to carry the weight of her awards.
I'll work on that, Philip.
About her new book, The Witches, Salem, 1962. Incidentally, I love going back to the darkness. I'm sorry, 1692. I go back to the darkness just to congratulate you on your use of Bible Black. I once wrote a column about the term Bible Black, which of course comes from Dylan Thomas, and I can't think of a blacker black than Bible Black, or in a more appropriate black for the circumstances. But let's go back to the sexuality.
Philip, may I just say that you're my favorite reader ever, because you're the only person pick up on that. Thank you so much. That's the kind of thing that makes you want to write a book, you know?
Well, it's the kind of thing that makes me want to read yours.
Good. Well, yours in mutual admiration.
Okay, but it's a wonderful black, isn't it? Now, let's go back to the sexuality of the protagonist, because in the Miller version, that is overwhelmingly important.
Yes, and you know, there is a sexual terror rumbling and rippling under the surface here, there's no question. And you pick up signs of it throughout. Arthur Miller took liberties with one of the girls' ages so that he could make it a more sexual story. She's much younger than he makes her. It's very hard to put your finger on how much of a role sexual abuse or even sexuality plays here. You do get a lot from the girls about how they've been pinched and pricked and, you know, made to sit down on pitchforks. I mean, there's a lot of sexual imagery here, for that matter. There's nothing in the court record that indicates any particular abuse. You do, however, when you think about it, have a bunch of young girls, pubescent and prepubescent girls, writhing in their beds, relatively undressed, and surrounded by a group of men, which is a generally sexualized, you know, tableau. In one case later, in 1693, there's a bewitched girl who, in fact, will dismiss all the women by her bedside but ask that the men will stay. So there's certainly something here to the being the center of male attention. There are girls who will point to specters, point to phantoms that they see, bewitched girls, and ask men in the community to execute them for them, or to, you know, wave their rapiers at these figures and direct the men through these strange contests against these phantoms to protect the girls.
This cross refers in my mind to the problems that many of us have about the ever early sexualization of kids in modern media. Mm-hmm. And also, of course, it speaks to a time of sexual molestation being the moral panic that's consuming the planet.
If you actually look at the court records, it's interesting. You see an enormous amount of sexual abuse. You have servant girls working in households. Most of these girls who are afflicted, I should say, and I should have said, are not living with their biological families. They are either refugees, or they are servants, or they are orphaned for some reason or another, including the niece of the Salem minister. So these are girls who do not have the moral masculine protector that meant that a girl in a nuclear family would have had. These are girls who would have felt more vulnerable, certainly in some way, who are, of course, just coming into their own. How much, when you look at the court record, you see a lot of assaults on those kinds of girls. You see even prepubescent girls being assaulted by their masters. You see girls being fending off unwanted attacks by fellow servants. You see girls, you see women being attacked as they ride to get the midwife for a man's wife. You see a lot of that on the court record. So it's certainly there. It's just very hard to connect it precisely with what happens in 1692.
The Puritans weren't sufficiently pure, so let's look at the Puritans. Tell the listener about them.
Well, this certainly plays a great role in what happens here. The Puritans essentially believe the Reformation is incomplete, and they intend to complete it. And they have pared Protestantism down really to its bare bones. This is a society that lives without any bells and whistles, with no calendar days on the holiday, with no festival days on the calendar, I should say. It's a very pared down, brutal existence in which one makes one's way from sin to grace, with some doubt as to whether one is actually going to succeed, and with the understanding that one might not know in this lifetime, until this lifetime is over, that one has succeeded. So it's a religion with an enormous amount of built-in fear and trembling.
Well, as you point out, there were double dissenters, and this also gave them an ability to factionalize and have fracture lines within their own organizations.
Well, you know, in order to be pure, someone else has to be impure. So there's already an enormous emphasis on what you are differentiating yourself from, exactly. And there's a need, to some extent, to demonize. So, and there's also an enormous investment, when you are an oppressed people, obviously, in conspiracy. So a conspiracy comes rather naturally to a people who have fled across an ocean to plant themselves on the edge of a wilderness, to practice a religion that they think is superior to anyone else's. So you can already see that there's a built-in fear here, or a built-in expectation that they may themselves be preyed upon by others. And in fact, when you start reading sermon after sermon, which unfortunately I did quite a bit of, you see those enemies, you see those natural predators blurring. I mean, if it's not the Quakers, then it's the Catholics, and if it's not the Catholics, then it's the Indians, and if it's not the Indians, then it's witches.
As we move closer to our times, the Quakers look better and better, the Puritans look better and better. But it's also important to recognize that with their apocalyptic vision, there are some parallels with ISIS. Now, I don't want to overdo it, but once again, we have a very literal interpretation of the holy text.
I can't tell you how much modern resonance I see in this story, in the sense of that strain of apocalyptic, fearful thinking, that idea that intruders are upon us, and the more so now when we can't even really put a face to those intruders. You know, they're out there, and they're somehow fantastical, and we know that they're causing us terror, but we're not really even sure who they are. And it bears an enormous resonance with the kind of thinking that these people were doing about witchcraft.
And there's enormous resonance with what's going on in U.S. politics lately, something we frequently discuss on our little wireless programs. So, okay, the good citizens of Salem weren't really surprised by the events of early 1692, because they believed that a sign of the apocalypse was signified by the presence of the devil. And as I understand it, witches were the servants of his satanic majesty.
Well, you know, interestingly, it early on seems almost like a marvelous thing. This is a badge of honor that the devil has chosen to descend upon Massachusetts. It's further proof that these are his chosen people. As one of the great young ministers of the time says, "Where would the devil appear but where he is hated most?" So his descent on these people and his touching down on eastern Massachusetts is only proof that these people are indeed the most pious, and in fact that the apocalypse is coming.
I had no idea that it was a point of pride. That's absolutely
yes.
Fascinating. And they've been on the lookout since the 1650s.
And you know, once you've been predicting an apocalypse and predicting it and predicting it, it's a good thing that it finally happens, right? So there's a certain investment here on the part of some of the ministry at seeing that your predictions have finally proved true. So and that's another interesting thing with Salem, is that when you begin to turn it over, you see that for every cohort here has its reasons. The girls have their reasons, the authorities have their reasons, the villagers have their reasons, and most certainly the ministers have their reasons. They're just, the reasons are not the stated reasons, but everyone has an agenda here.
I love their version or their variation on the Book of Revelation's prediction that the devil would descend accompanied by infernal friends, because if they were about, God could not be far behind. So there's almost tidings of joy in this development.
I think there are two things. I think there are tidings of joy, certainly, and I also think there's a sense of community building. There's a sense of communal cohesion that comes. I mean, this is a horrible thing to say, but a sort of primal rapport that builds. In the sense of expiation, let's purge ourselves of these unwanted elements, and somehow the rest of us will cohere all the better for it. There's a sort of tribal joy, at least initially, in being able to identify these deviant members of society and being able to somehow do away with them. The first couple of people who are named are the obvious suspects. It's only afterward that things begin to spiral out of control and you have very unlikely names named. And again, the reasons for naming those names are as varied as would have been the reasons under, say, the occupation of France. I mean, it could have been jealousy, it could have been rivalry, it could have been an unprosecuted or an unfinished piece of prosecution from years earlier.
Do you think there was an atheist in Massachusetts? Just one?
You know, if so, I wish I had his diary. I thought as I was researching, there must be papers from a Quaker or from someone in New York, somewhere else who was watching the Puritans destroy each other, who would have looked upon this with a certain amount of skepticism, if not irony. There's very, very little on paper. Yes, I'm sure there was an atheist or two. they certainly did not make themselves known. And probably he was living in Rhode Island rather than in Massachusetts at that point.
For about almost 25 years, Christopher Hitchens was a regular on our program, giving us his jaundiced view of the United States. And I, as a fellow atheist, I used to argue with him that it wasn't atheism that was destroying religion. We were just sort of sitting back and watching religion destroy religion. But it didn't destroy religion in America. It, despite its embarrassments at this time, it went on to become the most intentionally religious society, I think, on earth.
Yes, but you know, it's interesting. You can see, it's such a good point, you can see after the trials, this, first of all, the shame and the guilt well up, swell tremendously in the wake of the trials. And you can see the orthodoxy crumbling. You can see that the church, that there is no longer the faith in the church that there had been. The door is now open to religious toleration, which had not been prior to 1692. You do see that the experts are discredited. And you do see that the civil authorities will not again appeal to the ministry for advice as they did with the witch trials. So it does crack the door open there. That intensive puritanical strain, you're absolutely right, it's loud and clear and front and center in America today.
We absorb every American pop cultural and other forms of tradition, but we have until recently resisted Halloween. But next weekend it's occurring, and there'll be lots of young kids in your country, and I'm afraid in mine, dressed as witches, running around asking for lollies, which is what we call sweets in Australia. But, of course, in 1692, running around as a witch involving kids wasn't too much fun. How was a witch defined?
Well, a witch was defined as a confederate of the devil. It was basically a woman, although it could be a man, obviously, who performed unnatural acts because she had signed her soul over, because she had signed a pact with the devil. The Puritans, particularly being a people of the book, were very big on the pact. Other continental witches were explained somewhat differently. Until 1692, there had been no flying among witches in Massachusetts. This is the first time there will be witches in flight for different reasons. and witches had generally been older women. They had been women who had pasts, which meant that there were that many more reasons why you might want to indict them. And again, in 1692, one of the oddities is that you have young women accused of witchcraft as well as men, as well as young boys said to be in confederacy with the devil. And they tend to have done things like enchant your hay or bewitch your cow or made your rope dance or your kettle fly. They tend to perform some sorts of household magic.
You know, we shouldn't blame Massachusetts entirely for this strange attitude to women, because the whole-scale burning of witches in Europe, now well documented, was immense.
This is but the tail end of that, exactly. And this is such a minor episode, interestingly. And this is 19 or 20, depending on how you count it, people, as opposed to the 50,000 or whatever the estimate is for the continental witch trials. The difference is that it's New England at a time when the other trials have sputtered out, and in a place where one expected more, or one expected anyway a more enlightened attitude. And what's interesting is that it almost feels as if there's a time warp here, that this is the last gasp of the medieval world in some way, but it happens in the new world.
We've talked about mumbling, we've talked about the spreading of the word, but I suspect that word from Europe wasn't spreading too quickly, that most homes would have had just one book, a Bible, black book called the Bible.
Yes, that's exactly right. And it's an interesting dichotomy. Most people only had the Bible, and the ministry had immense libraries, or at least very, very good libraries. I'm thinking in particular of the Mathers, who were at the center of the crisis. And in a funny way, they had read too much. And that became clearer and clearer to me as I read that erudition is at fault here to some extent as well, that these men knew too much, and that because they knew what they knew about witchcraft, they were all that much more sure of themselves, and B, more able to diagnose different brands of it and to import different attributes of witchcraft, which are then applied in Massachusetts, which had never found their way before to the New World.
Well, Stacey, I'm glad you said that, because we've got to remember that many of the judges who sat at the trial were educated men, yet they believed in a literal interpretation of the Bible, which meant that witchcraft couldn't be dismissed.
Absolutely. This was part and parcel of their culture. This was part and parcel of the religion. And these are the most educated men in Massachusetts. And the Chief Justice of the Witchcraft Court is not only quite brilliant and brilliantly educated, but he is the go-to man on legal code in the colony. So he is acting entirely within the confines of the law and to the letter of the law.
We're moving towards the end of the program, but I have to ask you to tell me about Cotton Mather.
I have this sort of endless interest in Cotton Mather. Cotton Mather at this point is a 29-year-old minister. He's sort of the great white hope of the New England ministry. His father is the most eminent minister in Massachusetts on both sides. He descends from two of the most important ministerial families, and he's a prodigy. He's entered Harvard at 11. He's preached his first sermon at 16. And he is the person to whom most of the authorities will go for assistance or for guidance when this crisis breaks. So members of the court will write to him. It is pretty clear that Samuel Parris, the minister in whose household this breaks out, will be in touch with him. He's the person who's basically asked over and over for his opinion. And for various reasons, first of all, he believes in witchcraft. He believes in mercy, however, which is not a quantity in great supply. But for various reasons, he believes very strongly in the invisible world, and he will do all he can to promote the trials while pretending to, well, on the one hand saying, I think we should be merciful and careful, and on the other hand saying, however, the devil has come down among us, and we need to treat this seriously. And, you know, witchcraft is a terrible thing, and essentially does a great deal to inflame all of the events as they will.
Well, let us remember that it isn't necessary for a witch hunter to actually believe in witches, as of course Arthur Miller was inferring in The Crucible, because he was really thinking about McCarthy and his cohorts. So, okay, the What in the end of the book, in the end of the book, you write very powerfully that Salem endures not only as a metaphor, but as a vaccine and a taunt.
You know, my sense here is that the reason, part of the reason we go back to Salem is because it is an unanswerable mystery, and we don't like things we can't resolve and things we can't diagnose, and so it gnaws at us in a way. But part of the reason we go back to it is that it keeps us in line. It reminds us what happens if we overreact or we over-prosecute, if we don't rethink our ideas, if we do react instinctively and unreflexively. And if it weren't for moments like this where the train really goes off the rails, we might be we need those warning signs. We need to be able to see that before us so that we don't do it again.
The sad thing is the people that should or that need to read your book won't read it.
But that is always the case, is it not?
Yeah, but it is sad because modern America, which in many ways, for many people, is still locked in 1692 or thereabouts, desperately needs to understand the dynamics that you're describing.
It's, you know, it's my great hope that if you take anything from this book, you take away a sense that that humility is immensely important and that mercy is really the thing we should all be aiming for.
That's such a lovely way to end. I think I'm tempted to stop right now. Look, Stacey, thank you very, very much. I know you've got lots of awards. I'm going to give you another one. It's one that I bestow occasionally on a guest, and it doesn't actually physically exist, but it's called the Koala Stamp. So you've now been awarded a koala stamp for The Witches, Salem's.
I treasure my koala stamp. All the more so because it takes up no room and needn't be dusted.
Anyway, the book Salem, or The Witches, Salem 1692, published this very week in the US, which is why my guest is very busy. She's got to get up at 6 in the morning for her author's tour, and it's published here in Australia on the 9th of November. Thank you very much, Stacey. On our very next program, our other American friend, Bruce Shapiro, on the demonic possession of the Republican Party. Oh, and Professor Jenny Hocking returns to the program with new information on the Whitlam dismissal. Yes, there's more skeletons coming out of that closet. Thanks for your time. Stick around on RN for the news. We'll be back with you in 23 hours. Thank you.